You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Hello, Juliana.
You knew. You knew what would happen. You showed me that film and you knew. You knew I'd come here and I'd kill him.
You think I wanted to hurt you? No. No, the only thing I knew was that you, Juliana Crane, were the only hope any of us had. You asked me if you were in the films. You are. You were. Over and over again. Sometimes I'd see you in the background somewhere, a protest, a speech, a war zone, maybe. Some place that mattered. I started knowing where to look. You could never stay out of it. Some of the people you knew, I started seeing them too, revolving around you like an atom. But they would change, different behavior, different relationships, different points of view shaped by their lives. But you were always you. You and your unnatural, consistent mind.
What if you haven't seen this film?
Well, I got to know a woman who would bet on the best in us, who bet on people. No matter what the world said about who they were, who they should be, that woman would do anything to save a sick boy, a Nazi boy, even, because she would believe he deserved the chance, slim as it might be, to live a valuable life. And I knew that was the key, the only way to make sure that your sister's father wouldn't prevent that boy's father from stopping a war. Dixon died in an alley so that son of a bitch Smith could live, but San Francisco is still here. Millions of people will live because of the choice you made, the goodness in you, Juliana. One selfless act of love and hope. That's what I put my money on.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club. So excited to be here. I am honestly not even sure what earth we're on, but luckily in this dimension, still have recording equipment. And yeah, so I'm afraid to look outside to see what flags may be flying, but luckily somebody is here with me that I know very well, and his name is Nick Anastasio.
Hey, everyone. Hey, Matt. I'm glad to be here. I'm not sure which Earth we're on either. I don't even know what reality is anymore, but I'm just happy that in this one, at least, it's not the one that we're going to talk about.
I agree. I 100% agree. We're going to be looking at Man in the High Castle Seasons 1 and 2. I will let you know the strange story that led to us doing two seasons at once in a few minutes. But before we do that, I just want to remind you, you're listening to the 602 Club here on Trek FM, and you can find us all over the place. But the best place to go is over on iTunes at itunes.com/Trek FM. You will find every single show we do there. But, of course, you're listening to 602 Club, which means that if you haven't yet, we please do ask you to go over to iTunes, give us a star rating and review. Let us know what you think of the 602 Club. We'll let the rest of the world know what you thought of the 602 Club. We'll read your review out in the show. It's been a while since we've had a review, so hit us up with one and help other people find the show. We're on Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can also find us over on the web at trek.fm. While you're there, you can check out all of the different shows that we've got. And of course, if you're on any of the show pages, you'll see a little button that says discussion. That would lead you over to our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. It's called the Babel Conference. Also, you can find us on Facebook just by typing in the Babel Conference. And then, of course, we're also on Facebook as the page. Just Facebook.com/TrekFM. So before we dive into this, Nick, the reason, everyone, that we're actually doing two seasons, we don't normally do two seasons at once, but somehow I watched season two before I watched season one. Got to the very end of the season and realized that I had watched, the wrong season. And the way that that happened, honestly, was very strange because Amazon doesn't do as good a job of laying out their shows on their app as Netflix does, which makes it very clear, you know, season one, season two. And so somehow, yeah, I mean, I take full credit for just being an idiot and watching the wrong season at time. But
I think you slipped in a parallel reality where shows are told in reverse order.
Yes.
So you watched it in the right order in that other reality without knowing you were there. There's a portal somewhere in your house. Be careful.
That or maybe before that I was meditating and found myself in that different reality. I don't know what happened, but it's a good possibility that happened. So we'll be diving into seasons one and two, which means we're covering a lot of material. So we won't get a chance to talk about it all. And this will definitely be a time when I'm excited to see what people think on Twitter and Facebook and the Babel Conference about this show. But I really wanted to start here, which is the comparing and contrasting of seasons one and two. And I was very struck by how different the seasons are in the sense that season one is very classic season one. It's very straightforward. Many of the characters are mostly black and white. There's not a ton of nuance. And then the second season, I feel like, just explodes all of that and what you thought you knew, and turning a lot of that on its head. So I wondered what you thought of that as well, Nick, being somebody who actually saw it, you know, season one and then season two.
You know what it could be also? It could be you, because I know you and I are disciples of George. I think you might have subconsciously wanted to do it that way. Basically, watch season two and then have the prequel to it to see how things started. What happened?
With his nonlinear storytelling, yes.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm not sure, and this is not really important. I'm not sure that it was intentional. Instinctively, I want to say that they didn't start out and make season one with that plan in mind, and something happened along the way, and they realized what they had on their hands. And then by the time they were rolling with season two, they really exploited that potential. I could be wrong. In the end, it doesn't matter, because like any product of art, you look at it for what it is, and the artist's intention matters less than the end product. But I do feel like season one is really good in a very straightforward, black and white, like you said, a narrative, alternative history, things turned upside down. What if the bad guys had won World War II premise? And there are some nuances, but it really sticks to that very much. You know, who you would expect to be a bad guy is painted as a bad guy, and the heroes are heroes. Within the protagonists, I think there are a few shades of gray, but you know, I think Joe, namely kind of being this double agent character who,
yeah.
who you're supposed to kind of see, okay, well, he works for the bad guy, but at the same time, he's heavily depicted as a protagonist and someone who is reluctantly on the bad guy's side, but doesn't want to be. And is sort of like has a hero's heart. And then again,
it makes me think of that Cake song, reluctantly crouched at the starting line. That's Joe. Like, he does not want to be there.
yeah. But then, see, it's funny because when season two hits, and he's not the only one, it's not so much that he does a 180, but his character becomes 100% more complex. And it becomes a lot harder to put him in a box in terms of his actions versus his beliefs, his intention versus his actions. And part of it, I mean, you actually see him even question himself and go back and forth, but there's still, I think overall, he seems to be a lot grayer in terms of what he embodies. And I definitely feel like that was intentional. Like what they did with all the characters in season two, I felt was deliberate. Whether they had planned that from season one, I don't know. But within season two, by then, it felt very deliberate. Like this whole idea of taking your perception of the sides and saying, in the end, I think the message that they're trying to really convey in season two, by contrasting, especially to season one, is compassion and empathy is really where true good is at. And compassion and empathy will always trump ideology and righteousness. No matter where you land on the spectrum, you know, at the end of the day, true compassion and empathy is where real goodness comes from. And they play with that among all the characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real sense almost that, I mean, I liked the word that you used, righteousness, because I feel like, you know, the season one and season two contrast really shows that true righteousness comes from true compassion, true empathy, and that's where true goodness comes from. And when I say true, there, you know, there's that sense of that what we would consider the universal good comes from the actions of one person, and it ends up being Juliana, you know, and it's even said kind of explicitly at the end of season two. And so I felt like she becomes the representation that of all of then the nuance we see in the rest of the characters who in season two, we really do see kind of fleshed out and made much more complex than they were in the first season. You know, I think you were right to call out that when you're looking at season one and season two, Joe is the one who kind of is the most wishy-washy of the characters in the sense that he isn't quite sure what he wants to be in season one for sure, and even at the beginning of season two. But, you know, the rest of the characters, when I think of, you know, John Smith, you know, he in season one feels very villainish, very evil, you know. And it's not until season two and the end, I guess the end of season one into season two, where you really start to see, oh, there's a whole other side to this guy. And it has to do with like what you were saying with this compassion, you know, and because of his family and everything. So there's a really, I think, well done sense of creating characters and then allowing those characters to be less characters and more human even by season two. And I think that's the thing that it really captivated me, even and especially watching it the way I did, is being able to see how those characters came to be like they were in season two, which was great. And so the fact that there is this difference between the season one being more straightforward and then season two being kind of a mind bender was great. Because I felt like season one, if they had tried to do what season two did, it would have been more difficult to really get into the show, especially with the metaphysical and like physics of what they're trying to do with like there being, you know, alternate realities and everything. season mm-hmm. one being much more straightforward helps you really set a foundation. Okay, this is what this world is like now. And then when they start to bend that in season two, you can go with it because you have a confidence of where you've come from. So whether that was, like you said, and whether that's intentional or not, it actually, I think, works thematically, and it really serves both seasons well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know, again, like we said, whether they had intentionally projected what they were going to be able to do with season two based on one. But I feel like you're completely right there. Again, like when they did season one, what they did, which was smart, even if it kept things closer to sort of a baseline, is they did, you know, the fact that it's very linear and very, I don't want to say simple, but very straightforward, is because they stuck to the world building. And to do world building, especially in a complex, like visual narrative environment, you can't start to just throw a ton of complex ideas at the same time as you're trying to explain to your viewer the rule of that world. You got to sort of like stick to like, okay, well, good guy, bad guy. This is how it works. This is where the borders are. This is what we do, right? This is the basic mechanics of that world. And that doesn't afford you the time to get too philosophical with it. But like you said, then they had that. And then they started to go, okay, now that everyone knows the basic rules of the game, we're going to start changing things and going down the rabbit hole. And it was great. You know, wherever that idea came along, doesn't matter, because it was the right thing to do. The trade minister character, Tagomi, is probably to me the one who is the closest behind Juliana in terms of representing someone whose actions are not driven or become less and less driven by anything other than the close moral compass at the center of your heart and just compassion for the person, for your brethren, for the person in front of you, you know, love thy neighbor, basically. And to the point where he's able to, spoiler alert, I mean, I think that happens in season one to a certain degree within the confines of this very conservative and very kind of rigid society he's in, in his alternative history world. But even once you realize that our reality also exists in this universe and he's able to access that world, you see him be able to really go beyond a lot of boundaries in terms of not looking at gender, not looking at age, not looking at race, and then just learning that the act of love is just seeing yourself in the person in front of you, regardless of what the surface looks like.
Yeah, I really agree. You know, I think that Tagomi is a character that you really see... And I think you're absolutely right to call out, you know, like Juliana, it's the character that most closely reflects the attitudes of what we wish we were, you know, the best of us, right? And even, you know, I think one of the great things that you see is that he is willing to be silent, to give things space to learn. You know, I love his and this is one of the things I think is really important too, in the show. He's one of the few people of actual faith in the show. You know, because he truly believes in the I Ching, and the Oracle, and the guidance that he gets there. He holds on to that, whereas, you know, the rest of what we see from the Japanese culture, it's more of a something they just kind of walk through, you know. They pay it homage, but they don't really believe it, whereas he truly has a belief in this. And I think that closeness of spirituality was very interesting to watch, that it actually gives him the opportunity to, I think, connect then with the greater realities that are out there. So that when he transfers realities, he doesn't spend a lot of time talking in those realities, but he spends a lot of time listening and watching. And what he picks up is, I think, really beautiful in that specifically his story, the way that he, the metaphor of him fixing the broken cup, literally mending reality for that family, you know, like that the beauty of that, and then of course, you know, in that reality, Juliana is his stepdaughter, you know, and him mending the bonds with his son. Mm-hmm. And like all of that together is such a really beautiful picture of who he is as a human being, and that his goal is, like you were saying, peace. It's to find balance. You know, he only wants parity with the Nazis because he wants peace. He wants people to be able to live, you know, and that's really his only goal. And he's trying to find a way to do that. And then, and of course, that's when, you know, he works with Obergruppenfuhrer Smith, which, try saying that three times fast. And of course, you know, the head of the Kempei Tai, who's also found a way, Tashiki, who's, you know, been working with John Smith again as well, both trying to keep the peace, and they find this way to do that. And I just, you know, it all, the way it all comes together there is really beautiful. But yeah, I'm with you. Tagomi's character is one of the most beautiful. And I think one of the things that stood out to me throughout the series, and it's reflected in him and it's reflected in Juliana, of course, but that this show is all about how our choices really define who we are. And, you know, what really defines these people then is their choices when their backs are against the wall. Like, and that shows you what we truly believe in. So, are you going to fight? Or are you not going to fight? Are you going to stand up for, what is right? Or are you just going to follow this, you know, value that you said that you believed in? And so what you truly value when your back is against the wall becomes that choice. And seeing a lot of these different characters make surprising choices, I thought was really awesome.
Yeah. And I think his character is that much more important for the viewer and for Juliana to really sort of propulse her character as well, because once he crosses into our reality, or what seems to be our reality, because who knows, we may find out that this is yet another, but
one of many.
This one seems to have a history that's much closer to ours. And what I think is tremendously important in terms of a lesson, just like the two season act in contrast to show that love is love in the end, and love knows no color, knows no flag. This is what Juliana teaches us. But to prove the point, he, by crossing over, he shows the counterpoint to that, that suffering is suffering no matter what, no matter the boundary. Because there is, you know, when he first crosses, you kind of have the reverse effect as we have in Star Trek when in the mirror universe, you know, mirror, mirror, when the characters cross into the mirror universe, and it's sort of very straightforward. Well, we live in a good universe, and we've stepped into a bad universe of evil people. And when Tagomi crosses over at first, again, at that point, it's very deliberate. I think they play it so that it's very black on white. Oh, I think himself feels this sense of like, I went from a reality where everything turned out bad to a reality where everything turned out okay. But then he starts to see that it's not. It's just a different kind of suffering, but it's no less. He starts to see what happened in Hiroshima, in Nagasaki. He starts to see the way that Japan was defeated. And it's not to say that there is an equal, that things are being equal in terms of there are no good guys, there are no heroes and villains. But again, because it's not about ideology and who was right and who was wrong. It's about suffering, and he understands that this world, our world, if we assume that it is ours, just traded another form, one form of pain for another, and that millions of people suffered from the same madness, you know, which is righteousness coming from the wrong places instead of compassion. And I think that that's a very valuable lesson to learn through his point of view as somebody who crosses over between the worlds, because that really helps to sell, to prove Juliana's point and to validate her actions, which is I'm not going to take sides. It's not about one party or one ideology. It's about doing the right thing in the moment you are to help the person in front of you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the choices that they make then, you know, and I like what you're saying, because in the end, suffering is something that's universal. It's across all of the different worlds. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's what are, I think the question is the choice of what are you willing to suffer for? You know, because that becomes Juliana's choice, right? She's willing to do all of these things, and yet she continually suffers. She loses her, you know, her sister. She keeps losing until, you know, again, spoiler alert, the very end of the season two, when he says, "You haven't lost everything." That's not true, you know. Which I just rewatched that scene today, and it was making me cry again because it's just so well done. But you know, the choices you're willing to make. What are you willing to sacrifice? What are you willing to suffer for what is right, what is true, what is good? You know, it definitely makes me think of the Apostle Paul talking about those ideas. Think on these things: what is good, what is true, what is holy, what is just, what is right. You know, all of these things that really we hold on to. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, John Smith, when his back is against the wall, yes, he's a good Nazi. But when it comes to whether or not he's willing to sacrifice the life of his son for the quote-unquote values of the Reich, he's not. Mm-hmm. And it's because when his back is against the wall, there's a truth that goes beyond the rhetoric of the Reich, which is, no, family and the love of another human being, whether they are suffering as sick or not, they still have dignity, they still have rights, you know, all those things that we believe in. And so I thought that was really fascinating to see. Because, again, it comes down to when your back's against the wall, what do you truly believe in? What do you and what we see somebody like him, yeah, he's a great Nazi in other places. But when it truly comes to, you know, to shove with his values, what he values most is the love of his family. And that's a value I think we could all get behind. And I think that's just, again, it makes such a fascinating contrast, and it makes those choices so much more interesting for people in this show, because it's not just, like you were saying, this black and white thing. There is a sense of black and white, but it becomes about these people gripping with the truth of there being a right and wrong beyond specific, like, political ideologies, you know. And I thought that's fascinating to me.
And just as you see over the course of the two seasons, characters like Juliana or Tagomi, and how the closer they get to that reality that at the end of the day, good and right with a capital R comes from compassion and what's in your heart, what you know instinctively to be the right thing. You look at the other characters and the ones who hide behind or seek refuge or run to an ideology for surface strength, and you see how that becomes rigid and brittle, and how that, you know, you start to see, I don't know, because we haven't seen season three yet, but I have a feeling that this is kind of where it's going to go, is to show that type of strength is not true strength, and in the end it's always going to crumble under its own legs. And you see that with Smith, you see that with Frank, with Juliana's boyfriend or ex-boyfriend, I guess at this point, you know, and the fact that he's someone. And again, whether that was intentional or not from the beginning, they set him up in season one. You truly feel for him. He goes mm-hmm. through horrible things and you really feel a lot of empathy for him. Right. And to the point where I think at times you even sort of take his side against Juliana, because you feel like she's kind of abandoned him going through really torturous events. But the pain that he takes on, the grief he takes on, transform into hatred, and he just kind of runs, fueled by that, on this fanaticism, which then in the end gives him a sense of strength to help him, or he thinks, I think, deal with his grief and his pain, but doesn't really. And you can tell that the more he runs towards that anger, the more fragile it makes him and the more unable to really cope with anything it makes him. And in the end, that anger is going to catch up to him, you know, and the pain is going to catch up to him, and to the point where it does. And when he sees what he's done, you know, I don't know exactly how it's going to develop from there, but he's literally from death becoming rage and pain. All he's created is more death and more pain and really nothing else. And so I think it really shows characters like that, you know, show how that kind of false idea of righteousness never pays off.
Well, and yeah, contrasting him and the choice that he makes compared to Juliana, you know, Juliana loses her sister. And the reason she takes it on is not because of the rage, but it's because of the love she has for her sister and wanting answers then. And there's a real difference between that and, like you're talking about with Frank, where it just becomes this anger that overtakes him. And, you know, I think, you know, in many ways you can see how Frank's anger does exactly what Yoda says it does, you know, fear and hatred and, you know, death, you know, it just leads to those type of things. And so I absolutely agree with you. I think it's really interesting to watch all of those things. And also, you know, it kind of brings up the idea of choice in who are you depending on your circumstances, because Hawthorne talks about the idea that, in, you know, in some realities, you know, people are rotten, some in their kind, but really it kind of depends on, you know, they have food and they're hungry or they're safe or scared, you know, it depends on who they are. And you really kind of see that with, like, the choice that Joe makes in the end from season 1 to 2. It almost feels like he finally gets to a place with his father where he feels accepted and loved by the person he always wanted to, you know, and be connected with. He has daddy issues. And once that is secure, he then begins to accept the world in which his father is a part of and accept what his father accepts, because he feels loved and valued and but also secure, and it gives him an identity that he has never really truly had, instead of the one that he had been kind of cultivating beforehand, which is this, I don't really know if I want to be a part of this kind of world. And part of that has to do with the choice between the father figure that John Smith was for him, which was one that uses him, and the father that really does truly seem to love him, which is his true father, Weissman. And so, like, you end up with that choice he has between those two, I guess, types of figures in his life. And, you know, he does the thing that I think we all would do. We would choose the one who seems to truly accept and care for us, regardless, and doesn't seem to be trying to use us. But the choice he also makes is one that leads him down the path to being a Nazi. And it seems like a whiplash almost from season 1, but when I put myself in his shoes and what he's been through, it kind of makes sense, because in the end, what is the goal? You're going to choose to be known and loved. You know, who his father is to him there is a good person, you know?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think, I don't know if you remember when I watched season 2 when it dropped. I think it was last winter, and I was texting you. I didn't want to spoil anything, but I was texting you that in many ways, the way the story was developing was reminding me a lot of the way that I felt George was trying to write certain themes and certain story ideas when he did the Star Wars prequels. And it really echoed that for me. I really felt like that, like you said, that desire for acceptance. And in the case of Star Wars, you have someone like Palpatine who feeds on that. He recognizes that in Anakin, that all Anakin wants is to be loved. He has this kind of vacuum. He's someone who never feels loved enough, or maybe never has felt loved the right way. And he's always trying to get acknowledged. And the moment he turns that on, the moment Anakin feels like, oh, there's someone who validates me, he just kind of goes, he does, like you said, what we all do, which is say, okay, well, then I can wrap my, I can reroute my head around a lot of things because this person gives me what is most important to me. And I think that I really loved the way that the second half of season two, especially, developed as a Star Wars fan, because I felt like, I mean, I appreciated it for itself, but I kept seeing, you know, this epic version of the prequels done as a miniseries, and how that story, this political takeover and all this backdrop. I think what George was trying to do, this kind of idea of this huge operatic, mechanism, you know, political coup and toppling of systems going on backstage and center stage. You know, being this very intimate portrait of a love story and someone's lack of love and seeking love, felt like it was playing out in a really beautiful operatic and theatrical way in the second half of Man in the High Castle season two.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You know, you really can see the way that Joe is seduced into the life, you know, obviously one literally seduced by Nicole, and that she helps kind of bring him into that world and give him a comfort level with it. And then his father, you know, does the same thing. And I, what makes it so fascinating is that the seduction and the choice that for Joe then is not between, do I become a Nazi or not become a Nazi? It's, do I choose to be with the people who love me and accept me and want me, or do I not? And so it's really not about the other, the political realities, you know, and the right and wrong of whether, you know, the Nazis are doing good things or not. That's not even entering into his head at that point. It's on a very emotional, personal level before we can even get to that.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, which is, I think, something that's, you know, it brings it home as to what makes us tick as human beings, which is so much more than just these things of you know, the larger realities of right and wrong. It brings us down to what our desires are,
mm-hmm.
and how that shapes our reality, which, you know, the whole idea of reality in this show is always really crazy. And it kept reminding me of the C.S. Lewis quote where he says, you know, I find my desires, which nothing in this world can satisfy. The only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. And that quote kept running through my head because you see that in these characters like Juliana, obviously the man in the high castle, Togomi, this idea that they... Even Hitler has this too. You know, he's obsessed with these films, this idea of another world. And so you see that, and you even see this a little bit in, I think you see this a little bit in Smith, and I think you see this a little bit in Takashi as well, somewhat. Just this idea that there, something doesn't quite feel completely right, you know? And that they are searching for something else. And, of course, you know, we find out the answer that reality is made up into these different realities where different right. things have happened. And I, obviously, season two, I knew at the moment they mentioned the Heisenberg device. I was like, oh, well, time travel. Which I find... really fascinating, because obviously the thing that Philip K. Dick loves to play with is our sense of reality.
Exactly. I mean, I was going to say we have to remember that this is based on the Philip K. Dick story, and that was his thing, is basically exploring what is the concept of reality, what is it defined by, you know, your sense of self. And is it your senses? Is it something that comes from within, from without? What makes you real? What makes you an I versus not? So you can definitely feel that I know I haven't read the book, but I know it's quite different. Like Blade Runner is quite different from Electric Sheep, but I think they latched on and preserved very strongly the sense of what is real and what isn't. And you're right. It does come into play with many characters. I think in season two, especially when Smith starts to have, you start to kind of see these semi, and they're very, very creatively done. These semi flashbacks / almost dreamlike memories. This I think is what goes towards kind of the questioning of reality, because I think they're on the first degree interpretation meant to be memories of his life before the end of the war, when he was a U.S. soldier fighting for America before the U.S. Surrendered. But there's the way that they're shown has this kind of dreamlike quality. It almost becomes, it's almost as if he could barely remember, yeah. Or like it feels like something that he can't quite reconcile with where he's at now. And I think that goes towards what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the idea of that reality, one of the questions that I had then based on this was, I couldn't understand the one thing that does bug me about the show is this ready acceptance of people, especially in the Reich, the Nazi way of life. How does John Smith go from being somebody who is in the army, you know, Signal Corps, to being Obergruppenführer over the entire United States? How does, you know, a cop, as you know, Joe is traveling and he's like, oh, it's just Tuesday and they're burning all the cripples, you know, and the deformed. And you're just like, it's a WTF moment. You're just like, seriously, what the, yeah. how do you that? Because I mean, I think to myself, there's no way I would accept that. You know, and how does that happen? And I think that's one of the questions I hope that they will kind of deal with head on in season three, because I do think that that's a pretty big, it seems to be a bit of a plot hole at the moment for me, where it's just like, I don't understand how these people go from being a U.S. citizen, you would be sold out to freedom, all those things that America is in World War II. At that time period, to being people who could be Nazis.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about it, but it's a very good point. And I think, I don't know if it's a cheat that they're just doing it or that they will, or if they will address it. I think that, yeah, if it was something where you said, okay, it's the year 2022, and it's been 80 years or 90 years since the world lost World War II, or the Allies lost World War II. I could believe, you know, once you're on the second or third generation of people, right, who have been born and raised into a world where they've been indoctrinated, they wouldn't even, first of all, history is rewritten. They wouldn't know better. They would believe values that are ingrained since birth, and they wouldn't even question, in large majority, the validity of those values. But we're talking about people who have firsthand experience of the life before. And that experience is not even that far. This is 15 years after the U.S. surrendered. So it's, you know, it's not yesterday, but almost. Those memories would be very close. So
it's like a 9/11 away. Like, that's, when you think about how long that's been, I mean, that's kind of the time period we're talking about.
So it's definitely, and there are, I mean, there are moments in season two where you explore, I think they go there a little bit with Smith, and there seems to be almost a sense of anger, which fueled his sort of acceptance or embracing of the Reich in the sense that, like, he felt like, well, we lost because we were weak. And the Reich and its ideology is strong, and in the most raw sense of, Darwinian evolution, they're the better ideology because they won and they were strong. Therefore, that's what makes it worth embracing. And I think, I mean, I get it, and I'm kind of okay with that on paper, but you're right. You need to see more, because especially again, when you're at that ground zero of someone who has lived a life before, that's fine. Again, if there was somebody who was a kid and you taught them that, they would believe it without questioning it. But someone who saw it the other way would be like, well, but wait a minute. It wasn't like that before. So.
And I think you absolutely see that, and you're making a great point, because that's what you get with Thomas. You know, he's raised the perfect Nazi, and the perfect Nazi then, you know, turns himself in because he has a deformative disease that he shouldn't live. And he truly 100% believes that, whereas his parents can't accept that because they do have that experience. And right. So that juxtaposition is the thing that when I really got to the end of the season, the second season, I was really starting to get bothered by, especially when they opened up the last episode, Fallout, with John Smith and his wife being in Washington, and then they see the bomb go off and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, how do you go from being that person to being who you are now? And it's very difficult. But on the other side, you see exactly how, you know, their kids would be, you know, you indoctrinate somebody long enough, you tell somebody lies long enough, they're going to believe them as truth, you know, and that's exactly what happens with their children. You know, they are raised in a way to believe something that they believe it wholeheartedly. So he is willing to die for this twisted, awful belief that his life is not valuable just because he happens to be sick.
And there is a story element that could go towards explaining how American values, specifically America and American society, could have been undermined or weakened enough that a lot of people would have sort of given in to some of these much more extreme ideas more easily. But the thing is, it's not explicitly in the show. If you research the background of the book, and from what I researched, it is the same premise that they didn't change for the series, but they never talk about it. And I hope that that's what comes up in season three or later, because I think we need to have that. The idea is that it was already a different world before the Second World War. And, the U.S., actually, what happened is, in that world, Roosevelt was assassinated in 1934, and the U.S. never came out of the Depression, and so struggled on and remained isolationist and remained weak. And I'm not sure anymore, but it either never entered the, well, it did enter the war because we see it, but I think it entered the war later, or it was in a position of weakness. And so it never had the momentum that the US had in our world. And I think the idea is that because of this extra decade and a half of American society struggling with everything it did internally, you have a lot of people who don't believe in the values that they believed in by the time America and our world entered the war. And that definitely, I think, can be a huge help, but I think we need that in the show. It needs to be stated so that we see where these people come from.
Well, and when you put that into context with the late 20s and the very early 30s, there was a rise of fascism in the United States that could have taken over if the right people had won office. Yeah. We could have gone down the exact same rabbit hole that Germany did.
Yeah.
Thankfully, that does not happen. But if that is the history of this world, then that makes much more sense. You know, if that is part of that history, then, you know, you end up with Roosevelt being assassinated and stuff. That stuff makes more sense. And that will be interesting to see if they do deal with that, since season three does look much more like it's going to deal with the alternate realities and some sort of, you know, travel between those realities more so than what we've even had in seasons one and two. So that would be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a plot I remember reading about in history class, which was fascinating and horrifying at the same time. In the 30s, there was a plot, which was hashed by there was under a dozen people. They were rich heads of businesses. And I don't know I think they were senators, either senators or congressmen, who were, pro-fascists, and they had plotted to depose Roosevelt and to take over and then sign a pact of non-aggression with Hitler. And this is before the war started. This is in the mid 30s, I want to say. And it came really close. I forget the details now. I could definitely look it up, and give you the names, but it came very close. They were pretty foolproof. The only reason it didn't happen is not because they made a mistake, or it's because it's the classic, you know, criminals are actually usually weak. One of them got cold feet and went to the FBI and ratted out everybody. And so they got busted. There was definitely, you're right. At that point, especially in light of the Depression and how controversial some of Roosevelt's ideas were, there was a fairly significant, rise of fascism, in the U.S.
Yeah. In the 30s. Yeah. And I mean, it's one of those things when you just look at that time period, you see so many countries dealing with that problem, in different ways. And even, you know, so fascism, you know, takes over in Germany and obviously in Russia becomes communism, but it's really, this idea of, it's a nationalistic idea, you know, it's just, you know, so that really takes over in so many different countries in very detrimental ways. And so, and that's one of the things that I thought was really interesting in this quote from the very last episode of the season two. And it's what plays at the very beginning of this episode as you listen to it. But I love this when he says, the man in High Castle says to her, he says, "I got to know a woman that would bet on the best in us, who bet on people, no matter what the world said, who they were, who they would be. That woman would do anything to save a sick boy, a Nazi boy, even because she would believe that he deserved a chance, as slim as it might be, to live a valuable life. Millions of people will live because of the choice you made, the goodness in you, Juliana, one selfless act of love and hope." And what I really liked about this idea was that Juliana sees past the labels of who people, quote unquote, are, to just see them as human beings first, whether they're Nazis or not, whether they're, you know, part of the Kempeitai or not, whether they're, Japanese or not. She sees people as human beings, and she sees them with love and hope for the best that they can be, not necessarily who they are at that moment. And I think there's a real beauty in that, because what that is kind of what we had mentioned earlier, which is that idea of that's what universal good is in love, is to see past what people are labeled and see them first as a human being. And I thought what was really beautiful about that and what was in some ways, I think, poignant for where we are today, you know, the word Nazi gets thrown around a lot. But I think the beauty of who Juliana is that she sees past even the word Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really important. I think that that is the, I mean, we need more messages like that, to see to the heart of people, and try to understand them. And I think that's the beauty of this story from seasons one and two, is that, you know, the moment you stop trying to see other people as human and you only see them as whatever label it is you want to put on them, then that just allows you to treat them however you want. you know, however that label dictates, you know, oh, they're a Nazi, they should die, you know, they're Japanese, or, you know, like, it's this sickness that we have as human beings, and Juliana breaks that, and I think that's what's kind of beautiful. And what I also love is that he also tells her that she's the constant, like, she's constant in every universe. She is who she is, which is the same person. And that it's the choices that she makes with the people around her that usually ends up for good in whatever universe she's in. And I really like that too, that it also seemed to drive home this idea of this absolute consistent goodness and love. But there is such a thing as absolute good. And Juliana shows us what that is, which is sacrificial love. And I think that, again, it's just such a beautiful message.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think you said it perfectly when you said label. It's all about the main message and the moral of this story so far is look past the label. And it's not, I want to be clear, it's not about excusing anything that's wrong or bad. It's not about that. It's about saying the way to break that, the way to break evil, is by looking past, by not making it about a flag, about an ideology, about something that's a closed layer, but looking through that and seeing the naked person. Because at the end of the day, we're all naked. We're all the same. You know, we have that same nakedness. We're born naked. We die naked, you know, and we are the same. There's no difference. And so that's what that means. It's not excusing or justifying the evil that people do. It's showing that when people act in the name of false things that are outside, that are exterior layers, that is not true good. Whatever it is, whatever color you say your team is on, if you act in the name of that, then that's not true good. And again, this is, I think, why it's important we see the counterpoint across the other reality that we visit. It has suffering. It has people falling prey to the same problems in this reality that they spend most of their time. And we see that from every side, people falling prey to the idea that in the name of what they believe, that is right. And it's, they show you time and time again that unless you look inside for what is right, as long as you look outside in those outer layers, it will never be right. No matter how you think it is, how much you think it is, it won't be. And you have to look inside. And I think that's what Juliana does. That's what Tagomi does. They look inside for what is right as opposed to outside.
Well, and in a lot of ways, it almost reminds me of what you got in Wonder Woman. You know, this whole idea of, like, it's not about what people deserve. It's about what you believe. You know, do you believe that they deserve a chance at love? Do you believe a person has the ability to be redeemed? Do you believe that a person has the right to be treated as a human being and to give them a chance, even though they might not necessarily deserve one, you know? And I think that's the real beauty of what we get in this story. You know, who the Nazis are in this show are awful, right? But don't they deserve the right to make a turn, to make a change? And if you never give that and you never show them another way, and you just immediately call them a Nazi and write them off, you know, we see that. You know, Juliana has a huge effect on Joe. And the moment that Joe and her kind of separate ways is when Joe begins to be influenced by other people that lead him down the wrong path. You know, and so, but she has a really good influence on him. Even when she knows who he is, she still saves his life because she believes that he deserves a chance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beauty. And what's so disheartening today, you just go on social media and people are yelling back and forth about F you and stupid Nazi, and they just throw around all of these words, and like you are only fueling the hate. And what I think I love about this show so much, its whole message is that we have to stop that, you know, because the hero here is one who works for what is truly good for all people, not just whoever happens to be on quote unquote her side. She works for the best of all people.
The ultimate message is that if you remove all our clothes, figuratively and literally, there is no way to tell us apart. We're all the same. We're all naked the same way. And it's, you know, that's the ultimate reality, you know, that's the truth, which I think they're trying to say is alternate reality or parallel realities, events, all that is surface. But the truth, the one thing that's constant is what we are inside, you know, humanity, compassion, those things are universal. And those are the only things that you can say, you know, we all are. And again, if you remove the concepts of, you know, the figurative concepts, you know, that I'm talking about is things like nationality and language and ideology and all these things, you have people who are all going to be, you put them in a room and you're not going to be able to tell who's who. You're going to have just people. And that's what we have to remember, that we're all one and the same.
What did you think, because there's so, I mean, it's such a huge show and there's so many things we could talk about, but one of the things I was really interested in, especially between seasons one and two, was really the production value of the show. And especially the way that grew between the seasons, because I feel like there's a marked difference between how good season one is, but then how much better even that season two is.
I completely agree. I think it's there all along, but I'd been meaning to save it sort of for my final thoughts, because I had a feeling that we would talk about sort of the ideas, the themes more in our conversation, but I wanted to take the time to point out how well produced the show is in every respect. The photography, the writing, obviously, I think the writing we've talked about so much, you know, of things that have to do with the way it's written, that's already clear. But the way it's photographed, the way it's edited, the music, it's very well paced, with very nice sense of buildup. I think that I do feel like there's a significant difference between season one and two. I don't necessarily think that in the end it's that two is better produced. I think it's more, if I had to, but based on my own experience, I would say that it's probably more the classic scenario of you may not have as many resources when you start out. You may not be as certain and as confident with what you can do. And so you're a little more conservative in your choices because you don't want to take too many risks, and you have to be more careful with the dollars you have. And so, which is a very significant reality when you produce content, especially when you do something that ambitious. And it's not in a genre that has such a track record of, oh yeah, alternate history. People love that. You know, so I think what I recognize is more kind of the same talent, but more conservative. And then it explodes in season two because season one is a success. And all of a sudden, then everyone, which is again kind of a common thing in many, many hit shows, everyone now can sort of like let themselves go more full throttle and say, oh, well, okay, so now I can really play with my craft, whatever that is. And I mean, you have, I believe, I'm sure we'll be corrected if I'm wrong, I think it was David Navarro who did the first episode. If I'm not right, I know it's the same guy who did, who shot, I don't think he directed, but he was involved, either directed or shot, the early episodes of Star Trek Discovery. And it's a very, very talented, director of photography. And I've loved the photography throughout season one and season two. There's a great use. The music is beautiful. The soundtrack is beautiful in both seasons. But again, I feel like in season two, what I pick up on is more freedom. And all of a sudden they start to be, that extra freedom pays off into that much more sophistication. So, I mean, it becomes very operatic in the best of ways. And very enjoyable. I mean, the way it's staged, the way it's shot, the use of lighting, is just fantastic in the second season.
Yeah, I have to say the production value of the show is insane. And I agree with you. I do feel like, you know, it reminds me of, I think you'll agree, first season of the Clone Wars next to like second and third season, where it's like, okay, you saw what you could do, and now you just kind of, you make that jump, and you really start to push things. And I think that a big part of that is probably that they just got more money from Amazon, too, for the second season because of the hit that it was. And I do think it shows. I also think, you know, season two narratively and just the way that it's structured is much more ambitious, but that's because they laid the foundation that you needed. In many ways, I'll reference another film franchise, you know, the Harry Potter series, where, you know, the first two films are much more conservative, but they're needed in many ways to lay the foundation for that universe and to kind of set the visual rules that then you can play with throughout the rest of the series. And so... all of that together is really wonderfully done. I agree with you. The music for the show is fantastic. The fact they use Edelweiss for the opening song is just gorgeous. It's very well done. To play off of that, what we, you know, it pulls on the heartstrings of the Sound of Music and what Germany could have been, and then to see this, it kind of breaks your heart. And so, you know, I really appreciate all that they did there. And then, like you said, you know, the writing is fantastic. I'd say that production-wise, with just the acting in the show is phenomenal. There's absolutely nobody in the show that I don't like in the sense of what they bring acting-wise to their character. I think it's perfectly chosen. And then the other thing that I have to really compliment the show on, and many... and you know this from Discovery, there were no scenes of extraneous sexuality or violence that weren't needed for this actual story. I didn't feel like there was no point here where what you see on screen isn't actually a part of what's happening in the story, so that it's necessary, and they only go as far as need be for the scene. So again, I just really appreciate there's no random Klingon boobs. There just doesn't feel like anything like they're pushing a boundary because, oh, we're on streaming and we can do that. It feels like necessary for the story.
Yeah. I have nothing against, violence or nudity even, as long as, for me, good storytelling comes from motivation. Everything you see, yep, everything you show, everything you hear has to be motivated. You are, as the storyteller, the god of your own story. And so there is no room for accidents. There is no room for fortuitous circumstances or gratuitous circumstances. And so as long as I feel like what I see, what I'm told, is for a reason, a specific motivation that's part of the story, then I can get behind it. And you're right. Everything, there are moments that are very hard, where very poignant things happen, but those are all part of very important moments. And it's never done gratuitously for the sake of, look what we can do, like you said, because we're not on network TV.
For you, if you were going to rate season one and then rate season two, where do you think you fall with both of those seasons as we look towards season three?
I would, I think, give season one, if I can break it down that much fraction wise, I would give it 3.75 out of 5 dented American stars. And I think I would give season 2 4.75 out of 5 stars. I mean, yeah, you definitely feel the ramp go up. And it's not a dig at season 1, like you said. It needs to be smaller. It probably has no choice but to be smaller for the reasons we talked about. So it does what it's supposed to do, what it can do, as well as you can expect something this big and ambitious to do it. But season 2 is that much better.
Yeah, I'm kind of right there with you. For me, I'd say season 1 is 4 out of 5 cans of film, and season 2 is 4.75 cans of film. Like it there really is that marked difference. And but I take nothing away from season 1, because I highly enjoyed season 1. I thought it was great going back and watching it after I'd seen season 2. And it was actually very interesting to see that fill in all of those gaps and the way that the characters got there. And I thought it was, again, it's just a well-done season. But season 2 really takes, I feel like, what they did in season 1 and makes a statement. And what I felt like is that they leave everything out on the table in season 2. They don't really hold back. And so it again just creates that wonderful problem, which is, okay, how do we continue that trend then with season 3? And my only hope then is that they have figured out what their end game is. Yeah. So they know how many seasons they need to do of this, and it does not become that thing where they're just kind of filling in seasons, and hopefully that's the case. But I get the feeling like they've got to have some idea at this point where they're going.
I completely agree. This is definitely not the kind of story where you can say, "Hey guys, we'll wing it as we go." You cannot. I mean, if you do that, you'll get off with like 2 or 3 good seasons, and then it'll show and it'll start to fall apart. And I also agree with you. It feels, when I look at it, I mean, it could still be that, but right now it looks like people who are in control of where they want the narrative to go. That doesn't mean that they've thought it out, you know, completely. Like I said, I do get the sense that they probably along the way kind of got an idea of what they could do with 2 in contrast with season 1. But still, I feel like they're in control of at least the end game, where they want it to go. I kind of hope also that one thing that will not rein them in, but will keep kind of an end goal in sight, is the fact that Amazon is spending $500 million on Lord of the Rings. And I'm sure that in light of that, they probably don't want to be spending too many other hundreds of millions of dollars on other franchises and properties. So hopefully that's kind of an incentive for the Man in the High Castle guys to say, hey, you know, we have 2-3 good years where we can do stuff, but the Amazon dollars aren't going to last forever because they got to go to Middle Earth. So we have to wrap it up at some point.
Yeah, I definitely hope. And I get the sense that this is a 4-season show, and you know, you'd really ramp things up in season 3, you know, with the alternate universes and everything, and then you find a way to make a resolution throughout season 4. It just seems smart to me, but you know, who knows? We'll see. So thank you everybody for joining us. This has been a blast. We will be covering season 3 or soon after it comes out. Nick and I have already made that commitment to each other that we will be covering that. So
happy to be back anytime,
and super excited to actually be watching season 3 with you. It'll be a really good experience. We didn't even mention how long it's been that you've been trying to get me to watch this show.
Yeah, I was good. I wasn't gonna say it for about like what close to 2 years, because I mentioned it to you a couple of times when I saw season 1, which was good. But it's really when season 2 hit about a year ago, a little under a year ago, that I was like, okay, you got to watch this. It's fantastic. And I had, you know, based on we know each other, you know, we're good friends. I was like, not only do I think it's really good, but I knew you would like it. And so I've been desperate for you to watch it just because I knew you would appreciate it for many of the themes we've talked about. And so I'm really glad that you finally got around to, you had time to check it out.
Well, me too. And I am so glad that we got a chance to do that, because we've got great patrons here, great associate producers through Patreon, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, and Daniel Noah, who support the show through Patreon. And they have chosen the 602 Club as the show that they want to put their name on as associate producers. And I appreciate these gentlemen so much. They have been with me for a long time and making sure that not only the 602 Club, but the entire network keeps coming to you each and every week. I can't stress enough how big of a enterprise this is to put together. This is a really expensive thing to do with this many podcasts. And honestly, you know, it's free of ads for you guys, you know, so it is just free content. And so if you'd like to be part of the team, make sure all of this keeps coming to you. Go over to patreon.com/trekfm. See how you can support us. We have some different levels of contribution, which gives you extra things over there, the patrons zone and the patrons roundtable and all those kind of things you can check out. But honestly, in the end, every little bit helps. So again, go over to patreon.com and see how you can make sure that you keep getting this awesome content each and every week from Trek FM. Nick, it is so great to have you here back, and can't wait to dive into season 3. It'll be here before we know it. But is there anywhere that maybe people can catch up with you and talk to you about, you know, your love of something like Man in the High Castle? You're a huge, obviously, Star Wars fan. Where can people catch up with you if they want to talk to you?
Thanks. Yeah, the best place is to track me down on Facebook. I'm there under my name, or you can also find me in the Babel Conference, the Trek FM closed group that you mentioned, the head of the show, which I am part of, and I do spend quite a bit of time there. I also am lucky enough that you have had me on the 602 Club several times. I've been on some of the other shows on Trek FM. So if you go on the Trek FM pages and search, you'll probably find me loitering wherever people will let me have a back corner in their podcasting room and lend a mic to me for an hour or two. So yeah, those are probably the best places to find me.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, everybody, you can find me all over the place. I'm on Twitter, MattRushing02, and on Instagram under the same name. You can also find me here on the network every once in a while, getting a chance to record with Chris on The Orb as we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network. I do a few shows there. One is called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman. We walk through the Harry Potter series one chapter at a time. We are not that far away from being done with the Goblet of Fire, and then we'll be diving, of course, into the Order of the Phoenix. You can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we dive into a new Star Wars topic each and every week. It is a blast doing that show with him. I hope you will check it out. It's just joy. It's pure Star Wars goodness every week. And then last but not least, doing a fun show with my friend Courtney called Cinema Stories, and that's where we look at films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now. You're here.